Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Lesbian Mommies Radio. I'm your host, Elizabeth Kaliva. Thank you so much for tuning in tonight. I have on the show tonight Alice Ruby. She's the executive director of the Sperm Bank of California, which was the first sperm bank in the country to serve lesbians and other married women, which is awesome. I also found out, found Alice through a previous guest on the show, Christy Tyner, who, if you caught that show, was awesome. She's the author of a children's book about donor conception called Zach Safari. And Alice actually wrote the foreword to Christy's book. And after checking out the Sperm Bank of California's website, I can see why Alice was the perfect person for that task, because their website has a ton of resources for women and lesbians looking to conceive, especially, and what I found was really useful, is how to talk to your children about donor conception. I mean, that's amazing. So Alice was perfect for the foreword of that children's book. So super happy to have her on the show. So we're going to be talking all about sperm and lesbians making babies and all more than you could probably want to know about sperm banks. So find us online at lesbymommies.com. And if you haven't liked us on Facebook, like our Facebook at facebook.com/lesbymommiesradio. This is a pre-recorded show, so no opportunity to call in with questions. Sorry about that. All right, let me introduce Alice Ruby. Alice Ruby, the Sperm Bank of California's executive director since 2002, has over 20 years' experience in healthcare, including health education, research, and client services with an emphasis on women's health and sexual health issues. Her management experience and education have focused on the areas of nonprofit administration, quality improvement, operations management, and customer service. She received awards for commitment to social justice and community-based public health from Yale University School of Epidemiology and Public Health. Ms. Ruby is a research collaborator with Dr. Sheeb, I hope I'm saying that right, Sperm Bank of California's research director, and also the mother of a donor-conceived child herself. Alice, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I kind of introduced a little bit about the history of the Sperm Bank of California, but I think it's a really powerful history to share. So can you go into that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, the sperm bank started in 1982, and at that time there were no sperm banks that would serve women who were unmarried, which seems sort of surprising from this point in history. But if you go back in 1982, the LGBT movement was still pretty young. And there was a feminist health center in Oakland, and they were having fertility awareness classes. Well, the fertility awareness classes were intended to help women prevent pregnancy. But what they found was that women were attending the classes who were trying to get pregnant using men they knew as donors or men who were sort of friends of friends who were anonymous to them through a go-between.
Wow.
And the health center was committed to reproductive choice of all kinds, and so they did some research and realized that they could start a sperm bank right there at the health center, and so that's where we started. And eventually we separated off and became our own nonprofit, the Sperm Bank of California, several years later. But it was what's particularly unique about our beginning, well, a few things. One is we're the only nonprofit sperm bank in the United States. And that's because most of the sperm banks started as part of a for-profit fertility clinic or started independently as a for-profit organization. And so that makes us really different in our whole approach to everything. But also our population, because we had the first group of parents who were planning to tell their children how they were conceived, right? There was no social father in the family. And the wisdom at that time was that to protect the social father and the relationship between the father and the child, you should never tell anyone you used a donor.
Wow.
So these women came in and said, you know, we're going to be a two-mom family or we're going to be a single-mom family. We're going to have to tell our child something, and we want to. So they said, what information can we get? And they lifted this veil of secrecy that had been over donor insemination for a very long time.
Wow.
And they said, we want to be able to choose
information
about him so we can choose him for ourselves. Because prior to that, the doctors would choose the donor that was supposedly the most like the husband. And the couple would be lucky to find out.
Really?
You got no information. You would find out maybe his height and his
Oh my gosh.
Religion. And that was it. And so we were the first to provide detailed donor profiles and encourage the women to select their own donors. And that all came out of our community and what they requested. And they said, we want to tell our children how they were conceived, and we recognize the need for some separation and anonymity for the donor, but is there any way that when our children are older that they could find out who he is? And that's how we started our Pioneering Identity Release Program, which is the oldest program worldwide that allows the donor to decide at the time he's providing the donations whether or not he's willing to release his identity to his donor-conceived adult down the line. So about 80%, more recently, more than 90% of our donors are participating in that program. And it allows the 18-year-old or older donor-conceived adults to come back to us and ask for information about their donor's actual identity, his name, and some other identifying information about him, and we're able to provide that.
That's awesome. So now most sperm banks do that, right?
Well, there's some variability. Most sperm banks have some sort of open program, but I believe that most donation is still anonymous in the United States. And you need to read the details of the programs because each sperm bank has their own take on what open identity is for them. So, for example, some sperm banks promise a meeting between the donor and the donor-conceived adult, but they don't necessarily promise a release of his name.
Interesting.
We promise that we'll release his identity, but we don't guarantee a meeting.
Right.
And part of the reason we do that is things happen over time. We have had donors who've passed away. We've also had donors who have had, you know, a major change of heart for a variety of reasons. Now, that's the minority. In our research so far, and we've looked at all of the people who've matched so far, and more than 90% of the donors were open to some form of contact. So either a letter or maybe email. Some of them are open to phone. Some of them have met in person. There's a variety. But that means the vast majority of them are open to some form of communication. And the ones that haven't been open to communication, well, a couple of them have been deceased. And then there have been some where maybe his wife had fertility issues. And so it was really painful for her. And so he was like, you know, I have to respect my wife's feelings. So we try to look at this as it's a human process, and we want the best possible outcomes for everyone. So we try to do a lot of education and provide a lot of support to encourage openness to be available. It's also been interesting because we expected high numbers of the young people to come forward to get their donor's identity, and actually only about a third of them have been coming forward.
Really?
Which is fewer than we thought, yes. And of the ones who've come forward, they have not all chosen to contact their donor. Some of them have contacted their donors immediately, and some of them have held on to that information and 6 months, a year later, contacted their donor. Some of them have had their donor's information for long periods of time and, to our knowledge, have not yet contacted them.
Wow, I would have not
expected
that.
Yeah, we expected them to come forward much more quickly than they have. But, you know, we should have listened because one of the other things we do as a nonprofit is we have a research program. And about 14 years ago, we did a research study where we interviewed 12 to 17-year-olds in preparation for the first releases happening. And the 12 to 17-year-olds were actually very wise. And they said, you know, I do want to get my donor's identity someday, but I'm not sure I'm going to do it when I turn 18. Because I'm going to be a senior in high school, I'm going to be applying to college, I'm going to have a lot of extracurriculars. I'm not sure that that's going to be the time where I'm going to choose to make this decision. Wow. And that has turned out to be true. Most of them who've come forward have come forward between the ages of 18 and 20, so fairly quickly after they became eligible. But it's been a sizable chunk, but you know, only about a third, so certainly not everybody.
Wow, I would have not expected that. I really would have expected a much higher percentage. So that's fascinating. And, you know, I mean, it's really cool because I think one of the concerns we have as lesbian moms is, oh, is our kid going to be, you know, worry about they don't know totally where they came from? And, you know, is this going to be some like hole in their life, you know, that they don't know their biological father? And just your data is showing that most of them are okay with that. You know, like they don't even need to have, like you said, 2/3 of them don't even get the identity.
Or haven't yet. You know, they may come forward later. In the world of adoption, it's my understanding that you often see sort of two age bumps. You have people who start seeking out their birth parents when they're around the age that our folks are, in, you know, 18 to 24-ish. And then you have some people who start seeking out their birth parents when they're a little bit older and when they're thinking about having their own children, or when there's health issues that are starting to come up that they have questions about. So it's possible we may see a second bump. We haven't really seen it yet. We've seen a few people in their mid-20s and older who've requested the information, but we'll just have to see. I mean, donor conception has a lot in common with adoption and a lot of places where it's different. So we look to adoption to sort of get some ideas of what might happen, but we don't necessarily know.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That makes sense. And you guys
find.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, what we do find is that even for the people who are not coming forward, that in general, people who are donor conceived are interested in learning about their donor.
Okay.
And that I think a lot of times families want to diminish the role of the donor. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's, you know, I think it's important for parents to know that kids can understand the difference between who their parents are, who's raising them, and who helped make them. And that it's natural to be interested and curious about where you came from, and that doesn't diminish in any way how you care about the parents who are raising you.
Totally. And I love that about Alice, or about Christy's book, as she basically kind of had that emphasis, like there was a lot of respect for the donor out of that process, and not diminishing the parents. So totally.
Like, those can both be true. I think that in our society, we conflate social and biological relationships so much.
Yeah.
And really, there's lots and lots of families, not just donor-conceived families, not just, you know, two mommy families, but there's lots and lots of families where biology does not equal the social relationship.
Yeah, totally. Well, let's get a little bit into the donor process and how that all works. So one of the things that I was really impressed about your site is, first of all, how much free information you give out about the donors. I mean, a lot of the other ones that I've seen, they give you a little bit and then you need to start paying, and you got a ton of information. And I mean, when I was looking through the medical history, I was really impressed with how much medical history you had. So it seems like you guys do a really good job of just delving deep with these donors, or at least, you know, getting a lot of information out of them. Talk a little bit about that process with the donors and what the selection process is like and just how that whole side of it works.
Sure, sure. Well, what we're really looking for are nice, healthy guys, right? Like, some of the sperm banks out there say, oh, our sperm donors look like celebrities, or really what we want are nice guys. So we're looking for men of all ethnicities who can meet our medical requirements and who have characteristics that are interesting to our recipients, which often means college or advanced degrees, but could mean training, like to be a chef or to be a musician, special skills, interests, athletics. You know, think of all the different people you know and what they would find interesting. So we try to have variety in what we're looking for. But ultimately, we're really looking for men who want to donate for the right reasons, who are here because they want to help others, and especially men who are potentially open to being identifiable to their adult offspring, because that's really important to most of our families. And so we really want men who hear about that program and say, yeah, I believe in that. I think I could buy into that, rather than men who are like, I'm not too comfortable with that. And also, in this day and age, there have been anonymous donors who've been identified. You've heard about it occasionally in the media. And we want all of our donors to understand that we do everything we can to protect their identity and to only release it to their adult offspring under specific circumstances if they agree. But anyone who's a sperm donor could get identified. And we want them, you know, we want men to really understand that and not to sign up if they're uncomfortable with that. And so that goes hand in hand with looking for men who have, you know, a reason why they feel good about donating. And it's all sorts of reasons. You know, some of them have a relative who used a sperm donor or an egg donor because of infertility. Some of them know someone who was donor conceived. There's many different reasons why men feel like it would be an interesting way to contribute.
Yeah.
So then the process starts with an online application. They fill out a form online, and those who meet our medical criteria, who are local, who are in contact with their families and can get information about their families and don't have any clear disqualifiers, they're invited to come in and provide a sample.
So what are the disqualifiers?
There's a variety of disqualifiers based on people's health. There's genetic diseases in your family, if you have large numbers of sexual partners, that can disqualify you. If you have, if you're adopted and you don't have any way of contacting your biological relatives, those are primary disqualifiers right there.
Gotcha. Perfect.
And then they come in and they provide a sample. All of our samples are frozen, and then we test a portion of the sample. We save part of it in a separate vial that we then thaw, and we do a sperm count on. And that way we can see how their samples survive the freezing process, because a surprising 50 to 80% of sperm cells die in the freezing process. So sperm donors have to have extremely high fertility. There's plenty of really wonderful men who we have to turn away just because biologically their fertility isn't high enough. They don't produce enough sperm to make up for the numbers that are going to get lost in the freezing process. They're perfectly fertile for regular conception, but not for frozen sperm. And then if his sperm is working, then we have a whole series of screening that he goes through. He goes through medical testing for sexually transmitted diseases and for some common genetic conditions. He'll have a physical exam. He'll fill out a detailed personal and medical questionnaire about himself and about his immediate family, and continue to collect samples to make sure that his samples are continuing to work. In that process, he gets interviewed by our genetic counselor and by members of our staff who develop the interview notes, which are some of the free information we provide online.
Mm-hmm.
After we go through all that process, we assess his reliability as a donor. Is he keeping his appointments? Does he seem like he's invested in the process? Do we feel like he's giving us accurate and complete information? And if he passes all of those things, then most donors stay in the program with us for 6 to 18 months, making weekly appointments, and then they have to return again 6 months after their last appointment for a final STD blood draw, because all of our samples are quarantined for 6 months.
Got it. Okay.
So it's a long process. And we're going to continue to have intermittent contact with the donors over the years. And if they're in the identity release program, we have contact with them right in the year prior to when their oldest offspring turn 18 to help prepare them for the program.
Wow. That'd be kind of interesting as a guy getting that call. All right. You're going to have some kids. Now, darn it, what was I going to ask you about that? Something about them all of a sudden turning 18. Shoot. Never mind. I'll have to come back to that. So right before their oldest offspring is going to turn 18, you give them a call and give them a heads up, basically, that you might be getting contacted.
We have a packet of information that we send to them. So we provide them with resources and support and an opportunity to talk to members of our staff and get their questions answered. And we ask them for an updated profile about themselves. It's not required. We can't force them to provide an updated profile at that point, but most of them do. And that way, when we provide their information to the donor-conceived adult, we have not just his contact information, but how he would like to be contacted. Does he have a partner or children? Do they know he was a donor? How open is he to being contacted? Has there been any changes to his family medical history? Is he willing to share some information about his life over the last 18 to 20 years? So some of our donors provide a lot of information on those forms. Some of our donors don't provide very much. Occasionally one of them will just fill in the minimum and say, if you want to ask me questions, email me, or however they are open to being contacted. So there's some variability there. But we do try to get some updated information about them, and we ask if they're willing to share a picture so that when we do release the information to the donor-conceived adult, if that person's not interested or ready to contact him, they at least can get some more information about him.
That's cool. That makes a ton of sense. And I remember my question, which was, do you cap the number of babies that can be born from his sperm? I'm just wondering if all of a sudden he's expecting this like flood of, 50 biological.
That's a really good question. We have a very low family limit in sperm bank circles, which is we cap at 10 families per donor. We count by families, not by babies, because if we have 10 families and they each have one child and some of those families want to have additional children from the same donor, which most families who want to have additional children try to use the same donor if he's available, then we don't control how many children an individual family can have. But we do cap it at 10, and that's the lowest limit currently nationally that I'm aware of, and I've spoken to a lot of other sperm banks. Many sperm banks say that they follow the American Society for Reproductive Medicine guidelines, and that guideline is no more than 25 families per population of 800,000.
Oh, my.
That's a pretty meaningless guideline,
especially
in the world of sperm banks that ship sperm across the country and even internationally. So I think that that's not very useful in thinking about how many families. I do know that some sperm banks have a total number, say 30 families. Some sperm banks say 5 families per state. There's different ways that people approach trying to put some cap on it. One of the other issues is that a lot of people who are very private about their donor conception don't necessarily report their pregnancy to the sperm bank.
Wow.
So we do audits, and we did an audit in the last couple of years where we looked at all of the vials of sperm that we had released over, I can't remember if it was a 3 or a 6 month period, but over a block of time. And then we tracked all of them to find out, do we know if there was a conception or not associated with this release? And we find that more than 90% of our pregnancies are getting reported to us. Now, that's, again, tied back to the fact that the majority of our recipients are single moms or lesbian couples, and those people plan to tell their children. It is less of a secret in those families. And so the likelihood that they're going to reply to us and be actually really enthusiastic and happy to share their pregnancy and their outcome compared to heterosexual couples where there's a fertility issue, we find that about 60% of our heterosexual couple families are telling their children how they were conceived, and that's much higher than numbers that you'll see more generally in the literature. And I think that's partially because we provide so much information to make it easy for folks to talk to their children. And so if someone is on the fence about it, they can read our information and feel more secure in making that decision. Or it also is possible that they're looking, they seek us out, the families that want to be more open to.
Definitely. Will you share some of that information and what the kind of the tips that you provide?
On how to talk to your children?
Yeah, just a few of them for our listeners.
Sure, I'd be happy to. I have a handful of little things that I'd like to tell people. The first is to keep it simple. A lot of us have complicated emotions about our conception journey. But for your kid, it's the story of how they came to be, which is a happy and magical story that should be full of love. And for young children, you also just want to keep it simple and personal so that they understand as much of it as they can, and that they'll come back and ask questions as they get older. So an example, you might say, Mama and I wanted a child. It takes an egg from a woman and a sperm from a man to make a baby. Your mama provided the egg, and a man called a donor provided the sperm. You grew in mama's body, and when you were born, I held you and changed your diapers. Your mama and I are your parents. We love you, and we take care of you. So it's really simple. It's concepts a small child can understand, and as they get older, they'll ask more questions. So that moves to my next piece of advice, which is to tell early. There are many advantages to telling your child when your child is very young, even if you think your child's not going to understand very much of it at first. It gives the parents an opportunity to get comfortable with the topic and try out different ways of telling the family story. If you're talking to your 18-month-old, they're going to be very forgiving if you stumble over the words. And it also gives you an opportunity to normalize the topic. So children who learn early know that this is an open topic of conversation that they can go to their parents about when they have questions. And early disclosure ensures that the child is going to learn this important information from their parents and not from others who may be less positive or less informed about donor conception. You know, some people want to wait until their child asks questions, but by the time your child asks questions, they've looked around in the world and seen how your family is different than other families. Yeah. And you want to arm them with a perspective and a way of thinking about that as early as you can. We also like to say to tell often, to think of disclosure as a process rather than a one-time event. And that frees the parents up from having to explain everything at once. It recognizes that your child's going to have different questions and interests at different ages. And as your child evolves their understanding, you can evolve your explanations by answering their questions as they come up instead of feeling like, I have to share all this big information all at once. So it helps you to keep it light, and to encourage the dialogue, we recommend you think about creating a family book or having books like the one you mentioned at the beginning of the talk, Zach Safari, books that will enable your child to, if they're not ready to ask questions about it, they at least know they can ask you to read that book again. And it can help them understand that it's totally an acceptable topic to talk about in the family.
Yeah.
And then the last thing I like to say is that it's important to most children that to know that they, like everyone else on the planet, comes from two people, and that it's understandable for them to be curious about the donor. The fact that the donor is a person and not just some disembodied cells is important to kids. It connects them to others. But it's also important, as I was saying earlier in our conversation, that the donor's not a parent. And so a family might say something like, there are people who make you, like mama and the donor, and there are people who take care of you, like mom and mama. Sometimes these people are the same, like mama. And sometimes these people are different, like mom and the donor. The people who take care of you, mom and mama, are your parents.
Right.
And that is really clear and something that small children can start to understand.
Yep.
Some parents feel like this places a lot of emphasis on the donor, and they want to focus on who's in the child's life, not someone that the child doesn't know. But we find in our research time and time again that the donor is important to donor-conceived children, and it doesn't diminish their love for their parent or parents, and that this curiosity is normal and common, and it's likely to vary from kid to kid and from age to age. You know, I like to say donor-conceived people are people, right? Think of all the people you know. Some people you know are really interested in things like genealogy and family history and resemblance talk and all these things that have to do with where you come from. And some people are less so. If you grow up with the people who you are genetically related to, then you get a lot of this information just by being around them. If you're not around them, you might have more questions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally, totally normal and should be expected by parents. It shouldn't be scary.
Yeah, makes sense. Great tip.
And the last thing I like to say is you can do it. You know, a lot of parents get really nervous about it. And we as parents talk to our kids about all sorts of complex issues as they grow up. We live in a complicated world. And if you try and think about this as similar to these other complex things you may have to explain to your child, that may help you to see it not as separate, but as part of this journey of teaching your child about their world.
Yep. Makes ton of sense. I love it. And it just sounds a lot easier. I mean, I don't know, I guess at this stage, I don't have a child yet, but it seems like it's a very doable conversation. And if it's normal for you and you've got, you know, no weird vibes or real weird feelings about it, then it's going to be normal for them. Or it's, you know, just like the energy with which you're having that conversation with them.
Exactly. The more relaxed and comfortable you are, the more relaxed and comfortable they will be. They take their cues from us.
Yep. Exactly. So now, kind of along the same lines of biology, you have a program called the Family Contact List. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. We started our Family Contact List program back in 1997, and that program matches families who use the same donor with one another. Some families are interested in knowing others who share their donor. Some families are not interested. Similar to the Identity Release Program, we find that about 30% of our families are interested in this program. And of the families who are interested, most of them do eventually match. Obviously, it's case by case. I have some people who've joined that program who are waiting, who've been waiting for many years, and I have other families where there's five or six of the donors' families who are all in contact with each other. We like to say contact between families that share a donor rather than you may hear about the donor sibling registry. We try to stay away from familial words like sibling, not because we think there's anything wrong if the families choose to refer to each other that way, but not all of our families do. So we don't want to privilege biological over social relationships, recognizing that some of our families do come to see these other families as relatives. It was interesting when we first started this program, which, like many of our programs, was started at the request of some of our families, it wasn't a very popular program in the beginning. And around 2003, the Donor Sibling Registry, the founder of that, Wendy Kramer, was on the Oprah Show and talking about families who share a donor having contact with each other. And once it became a more mainstream concept, it became a much bigger program for us. So we have close to 700 families on our list, and most of them, I would say probably at least 70% of them have matched with at least one other family.
That's amazing. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. There was some YouTube video that came out about this. I don't know, I saw it maybe 6 months ago, and it was a story about a specific group of biological siblings that had contacted each other and that eventually got together. And, you know, when they were talking to the kids on the video, it was cool for them to see other people that, like, oh my gosh, she has my nose and he has my eyes. And just for them to have that sense of kind of a bit of where they came from. I think in that video, they didn't have contact with the donor at that time, but just having contact with each other like made a difference for those kids. So it was cool to watch that. It's cool to know that's a program.
Yeah, it's really pretty interesting. It's depending on when parents join, we see sort of trends in things. Like parents who join when their children are very young are thinking along the lines of the tell early that we were talking about before. They want to normalize this experience for their children. They want it to just be part of their experience growing up donor conceived. Other parents are like, you know, I just want to wait and see if my kid expresses an interest. This is, you know, I don't personally have a stake in whether or not we can contact other families. And those families often contact us when their children are in upper elementary or middle school when they start studying genes and biology or doing family tree assignments. And the kid comes to this conclusion, oh, I wonder if the donor has other families. Mm-hmm. And so those are sort of more kid-driven. And then we also have young people who come forward to get their donor's identity when they're adults, and they join the program at that time. So we have quite a variety. We did find in our research with youth that I referenced before, when we interviewed the 12 to 17-year-olds, that many of them were as interested and sometimes more interested in other children who shared their donor as they were in the donor himself. And we didn't ask a whole lot of questions about that, but in interpreting their comments, we think that part of that is because there's only one of the donor, and while it's exciting to think about learning more about him or maybe having contact with him, if you don't connect, it might feel like a bigger letdown, whereas if you are meeting others who share the donor, you're in a more peer-to-peer relationship. Yeah. And so you think, oh, well, these are people who not only share my genetics, but they also have a similar experience to mine.
Yeah, that completely makes sense.
And we find that the single moms are actually overrepresented on our family contact list, that our lesbian parents are about what you would expect them to be based on the number of parents we have in our total population. But we see more single parents, and I think there's a variety of reasons for that. One of them is that a lot of our lesbian parents, I think, have community where they are. So their kids may know other donor-conceived kids.
Right.
Whereas a lot of the single moms don't have this built-in community necessarily. Some do. Some are building it. There's some tremendous online and other communities out there for single moms. But if they feel more isolated, this is a way for them not just to have their child meet someone who shares their genetics, but also to meet someone who has a similar experience.
Absolutely. And I never thought about that, but that makes sense. Because in my community, our kids are going to know a ton of other donor-conceived kids. So it does make sense that they might need that less since they have that community around them. And it's like, oh, yeah. You're donor conceived.
I'm donor conceived.
Cool.
Yeah. It's like no big deal.
Yeah, exactly. So now it's really obvious talking to you about the research that you guys do. And obviously it's one of the things that we mentioned about you having a lot of research. But talk a little bit about the research end, because, I mean, it really is obvious when you go to your website how much information you guys provide. So talk a little bit about the research. Is it ongoing research? Are you guys always doing things? How does it work?
It's ongoing research. Our director of research, Dr. Joanna Shebb, is a professor at UC Davis, and she's joint appointed here as our director of research. And we have all of our published research available on our website. So if someone's interested, I encourage you to go there and check it out. We have two primary research projects we're working on right now. One of them is a follow-up study related to our identity release program, where we're doing interviews with young people who receive their donor's information. I think we're mostly focusing on people who've received it in the first few years that we were doing releases, so 8 to 12 years ago, and sort of asking them questions about their experience, both their experience growing up donor-conceived, but also their experience of the identity release program and a variety of other questions. So that's one thing that is sort of an ongoing project right now. We also are doing research on our family contact list, where we're working in collaboration with Abby Goldberg, who's a professor at Clark University, and we have did both an online survey and then longer in-depth interviews with some of the folks who were interested in that, and we're in the process of reviewing all of that data and coding the interviews. And that was looking at what was their experience of the family contact list and what is their experience of having contact with other families, because we know that the experiences are varied.
Yeah. Great. One of the things I love is just you have the success statistics on your website, and I just found those really empowering. You know, success rates with IUI versus vaginal and age groups, like that actually was really comforting to me to see those numbers. And so, I mean, just that kind of stuff is phenomenal. So I definitely recommend people check out the website, which we'll have that posted on the show notes, so you can all check out spermbankofca.org and get all of that information. So really cool. And I love that you guys are the only nonprofit. Not that I guess that makes a big difference, but I don't know. I appreciate that. So
I think it makes a difference in our perspective on things. We're really interested in figuring out what's going to be in the best interest for prospective parents, for parents who have kids, for their kids now and in the future, and for our donors. And not that we don't care at all about the finances, because we want to stay solvent and be around for the long term. That's a huge promise we've made to people. But that we don't have to make all of our decisions with the finances as the primary component. And that's why we can have things like our 10 family limit. You know, it is financially, it is better for the sperm bank to, if you have a good donor and he's interested in staying in the program longer, to keep him in the program longer and sell more of his vials, right? Financially, you're not rescreening a new person. You already have a relationship with him. It's easier. But we feel like that's not looking at the long term and not really looking out for the best interests for everyone. Especially with the identity release program, because, you know, it's one thing to be the first or even the fifth or maybe even the 10th young person to contact a donor. But do you want to be the 25th or the 50th?
Right.
Like, that's a lot to ask of the donor.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem like it's going to have the best outcome for the adults either.
Yeah.
We also are interested when we are looking at their family limits in health issues. Because health issues arise that are unforeseen. They happen. Either it's something that has been recessive and never showed up, or it's a new dominant in the donor, or it's something unexplained. Even with all of the screening that we do, they do occasionally happen. And if you have a smaller number of families for each donor, should something arise, A, it limits the number of people who are at risk, and B, it makes it easier to contact all of them and notify them about if there's a potential risk to a current or a future child if they continue to use the donor.
So is that something that the donor, like if something shows up, he finds out 5 years down the road, is you kind of set that precedent with them when they exit the program? Like if something shows up, please contact us so that we can inform people? And, you know,
we do ask them to contact us. Gotcha. I would say that they don't always, because they're not always thinking of us at the forefront of their minds. But what happens sometimes is that parents contact us and say, my child is being evaluated for this condition, or my child has been diagnosed with this condition. And we have a genetic counselor here, and she reviews all of those reports. And we'll often talk to the parents and sometimes talk to the donor and try to identify, is this a random occurrence, or is this something where we can say with some certainty how it was inherited, if it was inherited. And we look at the severity, we look at the benefit or lack of benefit from early diagnosis and treatment, and we take each one sort of case by case and identify, is this a situation in which we should proactively notify the families? Will there be a big benefit to them if we do that, or a harm to them if we don't?
Right.
And we look at all of that. We store all the information. So sometimes people report something to us. It's not that serious. It doesn't appear to come from the donor. There doesn't seem to be anything that could be done as far as early intervention or you know, it just doesn't seem like it's going to have any real impact on other families. And in those cases, we won't necessarily proactively share the information, but anyone who has a child from our bank can call us and say, I'm, Jane Gonzalez, and I use donor 2222, and I'm just wondering if there have been any health reports. And then we'll share that information with them. But we only proactively report it out to people if we feel like there's going to be a benefit to the families.
That makes sense. And it's good to know that that's a resource available. If you do have a question, you can call and request that information if there is any.
Yeah.
Wow. It's impressive what you guys do. Is that, I mean, is that typical for sperm banks to do all of that work that you're just describing right now? Or you guys, just because you are who you are and you're a nonprofit, that you do all of this extra work? I mean, it seems like extra work. Maybe it's not, but you guys, you know, really look into it and evaluate.
I honestly don't know exactly how much each sperm bank does on that. There are more and more sperm banks that have genetic counselors. We've had ours for a couple of years, although we did similar work to this with a consultant who was a genetic specialist previously. I think that we are probably more likely to disclose than some other banks, because it's as our history and our background of being part of a feminist health center and being about providing information and what we think of as responsible openness around all of the process, I think that we tend probably towards disclosing more than other organizations. But I would imagine that over time, and especially in the last, say, 5 to 7 years, that more and more banks are having this experience. We're having more and more people report medical issues to us. And I don't think that there are more medical issues. I think right. that it's there's more awareness about, oh, we should let the bank know about this because it could impact other children, because there's more awareness about genetics and inheritance, and it's just a more in people's worldview and consciousness now than it was.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Awesome. Last question. Just curious how you would say your sperm bank is different from others. I mean, obviously the nonprofit part is huge, and we've kind of highlighted some of those differences, but what else would you say is the difference between you and other sperm banks?
I think we've talked about a lot of them. I mean, I think our okay. I think our 10 family limit and our approach to medical issues are sort of emblematic of who we mm-hmm. are. Because we're a nonprofit, we have a community board of directors, and we have other advisors that include parents through donor conception, donor-conceived adults, donors. We have a medical ethicist. We have a lot of experts. We're very thoughtful about how we approach everything. And true to our feminist health center roots, we believe in providing education to people to make informed decisions about when, how, and if to add children to their lives. And we want to support all the diversity of our community. And I think that comes across in our website, and if you call and you speak to our staff. We actually have a brand new website that just went up. So it's all the information that you were talking about that you've seen on the website before in a slightly new package.
Cool.
And so I definitely encourage people to check us out.
Awesome. Well, gosh, thank you so much for taking the time to do the show. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
Oh, I think we covered a lot.
We did. So no.
No, I just think that people who are interested in donor conception, whether they're planning to use our services or not, I just encourage them to check out all the resources that we have. And people who already have kids, we have a lot of resources, books to read and other information on websites and other community groups and things like that on our website as well. So I would just say use this as a resource.
Yeah. No, it's definitely an amazing resource. So everybody go check out thespermbankofca.org. And again, I will have that in the show notes, so you can just click on it. Alice, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show. I really appreciate it. It was a ton of information, really, really good information. I'm super stoked that I'm getting to share this with people. So thanks again, and have an amazing weekend.
Thank you. You too. It was my pleasure.
Thanks. Take care.
You too. Bye.
All right. That was cool. Ton of information. I really liked getting to know myself, just how donors are selected and all of the different screening that goes on, which is, you know, you're relying on them for all of that. So it's cool to know that they take it really seriously, and they really do a lot of screening and disqualifying of people that aren't aren't good. So very cool. I loved sharing that. So hopefully you guys enjoyed that too. Have an amazing week, and we will catch you next time.